Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. This is the final stream of the 17th night, and I think this will be the either tomorrow will be the penultimate night or the final night. I'm not sure yet, but we are getting towards the end. And for this stream, I'm joined by Mr. D, also known as John D. But I prefer Mr. D. It's just a bit more sort of jovial sounding. But perhaps some people will know him from Academic Agents channel and also from his own profile on Twitter. It seems to have quite a lot of followers there. Again, I'm not on Twitter, so I'm not privy to these things. But welcome to Millennial, Mr. D. And would you like to explain the nom de plume, first of all? Because some people might not know.
Well, you know, strangely enough, it is actually part of my name. I won't say which part, but you know, I have a number of names,
Mister.
And yes, Mister is part of it, but but it is of course a wonderful happy coincidence that I share a name, partially or otherwise, with the famous court astrologer and advisor to Queen Elizabeth I, who was of course named John Dee, and who gets a lot of traction in various fictions. I remember him being a character in one of the Uncharted video games, but you know, and there's lots of films and such where Dee is a character. But he's a quite fascinating figure, you know, sort of a cultist and a very learned man. Had what was purported to be the largest library in Britain at the time. I would only hope to live up to such an august.
I'll tell you a funny story. I first heard about John Dee. So we're talking about a sort of alchemist, one of these very learned men. Possibly at one of those last times in history when you could have a comprehensive knowledge of almost everything that was known. And I think he was one of those men. Is that an accurate thing to say, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. He was, I mean, in fact, called often, I mean, my Twitter description for the years has been the Magus of Mortlake, which is where he lived, and he was, I mean, literally called the Magus, a wizard.
Yeah. And that's related to what I was about to say. I first heard about John Dee because he was mentioned by Terence McKenna, who was a sort of ethnobotanist, psychedelicist guy who died in 2001. And it was talking about John Dee in connection with the Voynich manuscript.
Yeah,
which is an illuminated manuscript whose origins were always very murky, and it's very interesting, actually. But anyway, I'd just moved to Mortlake in 2004.
Oh,
and it was a friend and I had we didn't really know London very well, even though I'd lived in London for several years at art college. I still didn't know it very well. So a friend and I just sort of traveled around looking for a flat, and we found one in we looked especially in that sort of area, and we found one in Mortlake. But I didn't know I liked the name. I thought it sounded cool. It's like Lake of the Dead kind of thing.
Yes,
it was, you know, quite spooky and autumnal, and yeah, you know. But I didn't know anything about the place. There was no significance it had no significance for me. But anyway, I just moved in there, and I was listening to Terence McKenna talking about the Voynich manuscript. And he mentioned John Dee, and then he just casually mentioned Mortlake. And I thought, what the hell? Did he just say Mortlake? It turned out that it's because Terence McKenna is this Irish-American guy talking about, and he just mentioned the very place that I was living in. And it was bizarre. And it turned out that John Dee had lived, and I think died in Mortlake.
Yes, I don't remember if he died there. His house in Mortlake is actually quite a sad story, because he had to leave it. He went to Bohemia sort of later in his life to work for I can't remember which king, which Bohemian king it would have been. So he traveled there and was there for years, and also may have been sent there on the behest of Elizabeth I to spy, because of course he was also associated with Walsingham and Elizabeth's, you know, sort of espionage. Hence, I mean, people may know that he also signed his, one of his signatures was basically the 007. It was a stylized grapheme of a pair of spectacles on a, you know, on a handle. And it, of course, it looks like 007. And, so yes, he was associated with cryptography and with espionage, but he went to Bohemia and he left his house, unwatched, unguarded, and it was ransacked, and his library, which I mentioned was a quite incredible library for the day, was apparently completely, you know, stolen and ransacked whilst he was gone. So I don't know
God, what imagine of that.
Yeah,
imagine quite, what was lost. That's like the Library of Alexandria.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, I mean, of course, and this is the sort of man who would have had, you know, things in manuscript, things that didn't have extant copies elsewhere. So yeah, it's quite awful. And as well as his own writings. I mean, some of his writings were published and exist, but there certainly may have been manuscripts and such.
God, that is terrible. It just occurred to me that, oddly enough, the very same thing happened to Terence McKenna's library. Because he had collected all these rare books and manuscripts as well. And it's the most strange thing when you read about it, because it's the library, after he died, that his library was being stored next to a restaurant.
Oh, no.
Called Goomba's Italian Restaurant. It's like, how the hell does this happen? I mean, how do medieval European manuscripts end up in America next door to Goomba's Italian Restaurant?
the curse of modernity knows no bounds. Oh.
Just dreadful. And anyway, there was a fire
in the restaurant.
And it spread and it destroyed all these fucking manuscripts. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So there you go. Just one of those terrible tragedies. So anyway, I see Semiogog in the live chat. He was very excited about this stream. So thank you, Semiogog, for advertising it. And he's delighted that we were talking about Terence McKenna and the Voynich manuscript. So I don't know much about
Semiogog Semiogog's a wonderful fellow, so.
Oh, yes. Yes, he is. I like Semiogog very much. I approve of him. And he's a good guy. And I was, you know, I was glad that he was on Millennial just a few nights ago. So let's get to what we were going to talk about, which was various aspects of art in modernity and, you know, being an artist in this age. And now, I don't know if I would be confident describing myself as an artist, because I'm not, and what I do is more, I don't know, other people certainly do describe me as an artist, and I always felt at art college that I didn't really fit in because I was too sort of logical. It mattered to me that things made sense, whereas other students were just happy to just, you know, make things and sort of assume that the end result would have some kind of meaning, whereas I was very sort of analytical. And so I will say
not fitting in at art college is a point in your favor in terms of being an artist. So
I wasn't impressed by a lot of people that I met there. Definitely. I mean, did you go to art college yourself?
I did not. I pursued things. In the end, pursued things related. I started out pursuing something else in the sciences, and I was rubbish at that. But although I, you know, it still remains a subject quite near and dear to me. I didn't exactly. But of course, I know and have many connections to such institutions. So I'm quite familiar with with how things go down at them. And I'm not terribly fond of them. Certainly, you know, as they've come to fruition in the present day. But you know that you would certainly say that of almost every institution.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, everything is poisoned and everything is corrupt at this point. And of course, that's been discussed endlessly on Millennial this year.
Yeah.
I don't need to go into it again with those other things, but I would like to talk specifically about art and the art world and the artistic process, if we could. But I'm not sure where to begin because it's such a bloody complicated subject. Do you think that the modern world is sympathetic or less sympathetic than it was, let's say, 200 years ago to the artist as an archetype?
It's difficult to say because, of course, the idea of the artist, you know, the kind of you know, what that means, what that word evokes to people, of course, has changed. I would say that we're still living in the kind of idea of the artist that emerged with Romanticism, you know, in the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, and early 19th century. This, I would say, essentially romantic characterization of the artist, and that remains. And I think, you know, we all know what that means in a way. The idea of the artist as the kind of solitary, sensitive hero, with all the kind of attachments that come with that, you know, the idea of the person, you know, who's sort of given a vision and pursues an individual vision in that way. But I would say that, you know, that the idea, what it means to be an artist and the kind of connotations of that have changed so many times over the centuries. You know, it is difficult to say. I think it's certainly very different now. And I think, as with so many things in our world, as they evolved in the late 20th century and continue to evolve, I think it's changing rapidly even now. So,
I mean, I don't even know what they're teaching in art college today. And to be honest, I'm not sure what they were teaching 20 years ago when I was there.
Exactly. I was going to say, probably not much. I mean, you know, well, I would say that probably today, and I, again, I have feelers on the ground in some respects. I occasionally talk to people who either work or attend art college, and you know, it's science to me pretty much like every other, you know, institution. It's you know, teaching a kind of raft of, you know, kind of racial identity grievances. And
this is the thing that is going to completely gut the whole thing of curiosity. You know, because there is no need for questions, because we've already got all the answers in the form of this ideology.
Yes.
So anything that you create should not be open-minded. It should adhere to this ideology.
Yes.
And it should serve the needs of that ideology, which is to deconstruct this and that, but never to question whether this or that should be deconstructed.
Of course. And the strange thing, of course, I'm not ancient, but I'm older than most people in these circles, as far as I've been able to discern. And so I remember
You're about 25, I'm guessing.
Yeah, 26, actually. No. I remember the early 90s, and I remember that basically in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a kind of the introduction of many of the things that we see today was basically happening then. So this obsession with deconstruction, this obsession with colonialism, this kind of you know, half-assed, you know, kind of infatuation with the Frankfurt School and, you know, French theory and kind of postmodern theory, identity politics, sexual politics. I mean, all of the things that are quite familiar kind of to the average person today we're all kind of coming in academia, in sort of art circles, way back then, you know, and I think a lot of people don't realize how long this has been brewing, like a, you know, like some sort of putrefied liquid,
I mean,
bubbling away.
My memory is that there really wasn't anything like that at my art college, which was Chelsea, in 2002 to 2004. And I don't, I can't remember any subjects where it was like the word Marxist was in the title or any lecture like that. I think it was more subtle. I think that nowadays it's not only is it not subtle, but it's just absolutely crass and in your face. I mean, it's like for the next hour, we're going to talk about why white people are evil kind of thing. It's just like that cartoonish.
Yeah. And you were lucky. So, you know, so as I said, I mean, it kind of reared its head in the early 90s, and then it was beaten back by various forces and with various motivation for doing so. And there was, it sort of receded. So by the later 90s and into the 2000s, there was almost this strange kind of calm period, this eye of the storm before things went to shit again, where, you know, kind of went back to, you know, follow your bliss, you know, ars gratia artis, follow, you know, art for art's sake, painting is in again, you know, there was this kind of rejection of what had come, what that first run in the '90s. And so you were lucky, because I think, you know, judging by when you were there, you kind of missed a lot of it.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, I'm not sure what was taught, but I do remember one lecture about beauty and the sublime, and I really enjoyed that. I remember really enjoying that. I didn't know of that distinction until then. Then there was another lecture about the archetype of the flaneur, which is a sort of a man who wanders a city every day, and that's all he does. He just wanders the city, observing people. I remember that, and that's really all that I can remember of the lectures. It's two lectures. But the other aspect, I mean, there are several aspects. One thing I noticed was that no one seemed to care about the dignity of creating something. What you had was people who were, it looked to me like they were just on the make. They were good business. They were good at business. They were good at selling themselves. They were good at, you know, getting out there and negotiating with people, which is, I mean, these are essential skills if you want to make it in the art world. In a way, I was jealous of them, but I also noted that they just didn't seem to care about, there wasn't a sort of love for their own work or a concern for it. It seemed very much like a business, whereas I was very I cared, like, in the same way that I still do now. I care very much that everything I do is as good as I can make it, and that it has a point. I want to know what the point is of each thing that I do. Otherwise, I feel guilty that I might be wasting people's time. But that none of these, and you know, I'm not trying to boast and paint myself as a really great guy. I'm just saying it surprised me and sort of disgusted me that no one else seemed to have that attitude, when it was what I thought art college would. I thought it would be full of people who had that sort of attitude, and it really wasn't at all.
No, I mean, you know, and of course, obviously, it is again one of these difficult distinctions, because, you know, if you intend to make a career out of it, one way or the other, then of course you do need to think practically. But I think there has to be a balance. I mean, there has to be a reason for you to be able to market yourself. I mean, there has to be a reason why that's going to sustain your work whatever it is, if it's, you know, again, a more commercial thing, or if it's, you know, sort of fine art in a, you know, in a gallery setting, or some sort of design, or, you know, whatever it may be. You know, I think what there has to be a balance between these things. And of course, I know exactly the type you're describing. I mean, the art world, such as it is, I think it's falling apart in a way at the moment. But, you know, it's filled with these kind of careerist mediocrities. You know, they tend to be rewarded. But, you know, these are the type of people who tend to be rewarded whatever they get into, you know, yes. Whether it's journalism or whatever, you know. I mean, the world as we've configured it favors this type of creature. It is a difficult balance, yeah.
So what do you mean by when you say that the art world is falling apart in a way?
Well, as with so many other things, you know, at the current time, I mean, we're on the precipice of what is that quote that gets passed around as a meme from Nikola Tesla, you know, a man-made horrors beyond your comprehension, you know. You will live to see man-made horrors beyond your comprehension, something like that. And I mean, we are living in the kind of, we're entering into a very unknown world, and how the world will reconfigure itself, either both politically, technologically, it's all quite uncertain. And I would say the art, the commercial, the kind of commercial gallery, art world, you know, that people sort of think of, I would say it's very much uncertain what's going to happen to it, of course, because, you know, we're moving into an age where the physical is disappearing in a sense. And of course, so much of this idea of art as a saleable object, as a commodity, is predicated on the idea of physical, and the idea of an object. And of course, you know, everything in society is moving away from that. So this traditional model of the artist and the art gallery and the art museum in the world is, of course, changing. And I don't know what's going to happen to it. I don't think anyone else does. I mean, and we see the rise of this, you know, with the NFTs and all of that. And I mean, that's a serious threat to this kind of 20th century conception of what it means to be a functioning artist.
That's an interesting. I mean, I should say that I have created an NFT for Millennial for this year, yeah. And I'm selling it. But it is, and this is the thing. It actually goes back to what I was just saying. That is one that I put a huge amount of work into creating this vector graphic that glistens. It's like a stained glass window of the Millennial logo. And you know, there was an awful lot of work that went into it, and you know, love and all this. So I don't feel guilty about it. I mean, I wouldn't feel guilty about getting money for it, because I know that I poured a lot into it. So if it does sell as an NFT, then I feel okay, that's fine. But I understand what you're saying about the whole NFT thing is bizarre. I don't quite understand it. I don't feel quite qualified to discuss it. But it's where the object itself doesn't really matter so much as the certificate that says you own the object. And the object could be copied by other people and just given around. But you own the original because you've got that certificate, yeah. So to speak. It's so the physical stuff, or in this case, a digital file can be copied even more easily. The physical stuff doesn't really matter. It's just about the fact of ownership. It's the fact that you own it. It doesn't matter if everyone else has got one too for free. You've got the right to it. It's strange. It's a strange thing. It gets away completely from the idea that value is labor. Like, the labor theory of value, I guess.
The labor theory of value. I hear my friend academic agents, you know, econ senses tingling somewhere.
Foundations, you know, but I think of economics.
Buy it. No. Yeah, I mean, I think we've actually, you know, there are many kind of examples of proto models of this idea, you know, that's present in the idea of an NFT. I think, you know, certainly conceptual art and installation art, you know, think movements that happened in the 1960s, 1970s, and 80s, were the kind of, you know, forerunners of this idea. You know, that I think the 20th century, there was a strain of contemporary art that was kind of moving away from this idea of physical. And certainly well before there were computers at all, there was the idea that, you know, in certain artists explored this idea that you could purchase basically a share in something. You know, you weren't purchasing an object, you were purchasing, you know, a kind of incorporeal spiritual right to it. I mean, Marcel Duchamp did something like this several times in his career, you know, sort of selling shares in things. So I don't think it's an entirely new idea. And of course, you know, there's other kind of relationships with that. I mean, the print market. So if people are aware of many fine artists do prints of their work. They do limited edition prints, you know. And so these aren't necessarily like original artworks. I mean, they're you know, the design of the print was the original artwork, and then a set number of copies are made, and you buy those copies. So you're aware that you're not buying a completely unique thing, but you're buying something that is editioned, and there's a whole sort of sense of trust around the fact that the edition has a limited number and such. So, you know, I think that whilst it may seem kind of a totally new thing, I think that the kind of seeds of this are all over the place and have been there for quite a long time. Yeah. I don't understand I will also say that I don't really understand the NFT thing. I mean, it's just not for me. Even though I use computers extensively in various aspects of my work, then it's, you know, in the end, of course, I'm quite a traditional artist, you know, but I mean, I do use them as tools for certain things, but I'm not a digital artist in that sense. So, it's something that I choose not to get involved in because I don't have time.
So you would have seen the rise of digital media.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Digital art in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, laughable things, you know, you can't imagine, you know, the kind of shite that got airplay just because it was digital. I mean, the mid to late 90s were just a complete farce in terms of, you know, all the cyborg, all the kind of cringe 90s sort of, you know, bad inkjet prints. You know, you put the magical imprimatur of digital or computer on it, you know, internet art, you know. But, you know, it's all quite cringe in retrospect. But yeah, I mean, that's certainly something that was happening then.
It's funny you bring up the cyborg thing, because I remember that specifically. I associate the late 90s with that, because I can remember going to a bookshop in Edinburgh. I think it was either Watterson's or James Thind. I can't remember, but it was a big bookshop. And I used to go there every Saturday, and I would always go to this book that was called The Cyborg Handbook. It was always on this. It was on this shelf, and I never bought it because I didn't have any money. But I would go and look at it and just leaf through it, and it was elsewhere as well. I mean, it was in the music of that decade, the cyborg stuff. Of course, it got also in the 80s in film cinema. But in the late 90s, there was also talk of, you know, virtual reality. There was talk of cyber cafes were emerging. There was one in Edinburgh from 95 onwards, and then there was also talk of cyber sex, which I mean, obviously, you know, it's just seems funny now, you know. It's like no one talks about cyber sex in this day and age, but back then it was a thing that it seemed like, oh, in the future everyone will be having cyber sex. And everyone will be a cyborg. Well, you know, maybe one of those two things is true.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we're going to all have our shag in the what is it called, the metaverse, that now, you know, we're all going to go into the metaverse and shag.
I mean, well, I actually meant the cyborg part. I'm not sure, but
Cyborgs.
But at that time, it seemed like that you could tell that there was a subculture of people who were interested. It was sort of there in the, you could tell it must be in the art colleges because there were books coming out about it, like that one, and I just remember being aware of it, not just because it was the kind of thing that appeals to me. I'm into science fiction and stuff, but because it was there in the sort of cultural fabric. Because it's funny to think, because back then, you know, now that era, the late 90s, seems quaint. But there was this thing about, you know, rave music and digital art, computers, the internet, and virtual reality. Although virtual reality sort of fell away after the early 90s, its promise was completely, it was just forgotten about for about 20
years.
Well,
because it was shite. It was total shite.
It was completely unworkable. And it came back about 20 years later, like about 2010. But anyway, the point is that it was definitely there, and people were aware that in the future there is going to be immersive media. Yeah. It's inevitable. We don't know how long it'll take to get here, but it will be there. And so that was all there. And I forgot how we got. Oh yeah, so we're talking about the late 90s and digital art.
I think there was
this process, this phase of people trying to integrate, trying to digest what is the future going to be, and not the distant future, like not 1,000 years from now, but 50 years from now. But now we realize it was actually like 22 years from then. So it was there and people were trying to digest it. And I don't think, and then it, in the end, the 2000s started, and so many things just disappeared. And this is one of them. And we're replaced by a sort of nothing. And I've said this many times, that to me, the 2000s just seems like an empty decade. Like nothing really there. And then social media arrived.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, I've discussed this with many people over the years, that it almost seemed like culture stopped in about around the year 2000. I mean, you know, I mean, there's, you know, if you go to, like, if you look at the 1950s, you can easily point it out. The aesthetics, the art, the, you know, the fashion, whatever, it is a thing. The 1960s, you know, whatever year of the 1960s you're talking about, it is a distinct thing. The 70s is a distinct thing. The 80s is a distinct thing. I mean, each of these 10-year periods, you know, they're very clearly... Oh.
I would go even further. It's more like three year. You could divide each one into three.
Yes, you could divide them up. But
the early 90s, the late, yeah, mid, and
they were clearly, I mean, of, you know, they had an identity. And then I would say that starting in about 2000, I would challenge people to be able to do this. I mean, obviously, yes, of course, there's cultural products that came out all through the 2000s. But I would say that it almost seemed like, you know, the nature of cultural change really kind of stagnated, and there isn't that much. I mean, of course, having, you know, lived through all these past 20 years, quite, you know, as an adult, I remember very clearly what all those years were like, and you know, the world today, I mean, obviously, just the cultural world today is not terribly different from the way it was 5, 10, 15 years ago. So something very strange happened, I think, to culture. Oh,
absolutely. I went into this, I told an anecdote in one of the previous streams. I can't remember which one it was, but I brought this topic up in quite a few of the streams in Millennial this year, of the fact that everything seems to have frozen for the last 20 years. And I told this anecdote about, I was at a friend's house watching, and this game show was on TV, and this was like earlier this year, And it was obviously a repeat because it was just sort of endless episodes of this game show on that he was watching on this channel. So it was obviously reruns of old episodes. And so I just assumed it was probably a couple of years old, this episode. And then one of the contestants said something which made me realize that it wasn't from like 2019 or 2018. It was actually from 2009.
Mm.
And because they referred to someone who'd just got divorced, and I Googled it, and it was in, they got divorced in 2008. So basically, I had confused 2009 for 2019. And like everything in the hairstyles, the clothes they were wearing, the style of the graphics, the sophistication of the graphics, everything. 10 years had passed, and I didn't know. Yeah. Now, that's the point. It's like that you cannot imagine of that happening in any like 1975 no. being confused with 1965 or 1985
yes, or 85. Just, never yeah. in a million years. No.
Unthinkable, completely unthinkable. So yeah, it's a very strange, but at the same time, culture clearly has changed. Compare the world in 2000, like the Western, I mean us, our world, Britain. Compare that in 2000 with Britain in 2019, before COVID, like just that world. In that 20 years, a lot changed about our views of marriage, our views of trans, our views of men and women, our views of personal liberty, our views of capitalism and what it is to be a consumer, what it is to be a citizen. I think, and of course, social media arrived as well. So that our view of fame, our view of what it is to be prominent, what it is to gain social accolades, these things all changed. But meantime, the aesthetics, the visuals, the sounds around us, stayed basically exactly the same.
Well, I would analogize that to, you know, it's almost as if, of course, the organism, you know, it's like the organism died and, you know, was mummified in around the year 2000. And whilst the, you know, the skin perfectly preserved and plasticized, you know, changes very little, underneath everything is rotting away, you know. I mean, in the time that the face of culture seemingly hasn't changed that much, I think underneath, basically all the foundations of our entire civilization have been crumbling and falling away quite deliberately. So so there's almost a kind of sinister aspect that, of course, roiling underneath this kind of plastic surface is, of course, quite horrible things, you know. So maybe, you know, the change is no longer manifest in the face of culture, I would say.
Yeah, it's as if the face of culture remains the same because there is no connection between it and what's actually going on underneath.
Yeah, and possibly by design. I mean, that of course is a wonderful thing. To the powers that be, you know, that's how they would want it. And I think that, you know, obviously the internet and the kind of increasing connection of the world through internet and the web has also contributed to the kind of homogeneity of human culture. I think that's fairly undeniable, that was a contributing factor. It's odd. I mean, people are becoming well, you know, again, the back to the cyborg thing. Speaking of cyborgs, there was an essay, I can't remember, that written in the mid-80s called Cyborg Manifesto by Donna Haraway. And I would certainly advise, if people haven't heard of that, to look into it, because a lot of the kind of sinister ideas about the nature of humans and transhumanism and the kind of relationship of the human to the state and the relation of the human to the, you know, the kind of the world, is in that essay. And I would think, and I think a lot of people were influenced by that, and not, and that wasn't a good thing. you know, but that is something I certainly remember, and that came up a lot in the early 90s as people were kind of, you know, getting in very interested in these ideas.
Of course, the other thing I meant to mention earlier was there was the it was Nick Land was involved in it.
Yes, I was going to mention him. He was coming of age at that time in the late 80s, early 90s, and part of that entire kind of thought.
There it is. It was called the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit at Warwick University, and it was formed in late 1995. But predating it was Nick Land and Sadie Plant. Oh, sorry, Sadie Plant, working in the University of Warwick, formed the collective around 1993 as a cyber feminist research group.
There you go. Well, it's exactly what the Donna Haraway essay that I mentioned. It is exactly what that's about. I mean, this group of people, including Nick Land, is very, very odd because he's one of the few of those of that set who's still kind of around, at least that I'm aware of. But yeah, I mean, that the origins of that were quite long ago, in the first, you know, the first emergence of this kind of vision of the future that is now coming to fruition.
That's the thing. It was predicted then, and now it's happening 20 years later, but there has been no, like, the prediction happened, a bit of cultural activity around it happened, and then it just stopped. And then 20 years later, it's arriving, but we've done no preparation for it. It's just all, it stopped in 1999.
Yeah.
Well, ironically, when The Matrix came out.
there it is. And I certainly think the Matrix was a product of that sort of bit of the zeitgeist at the time. You know, you see a lot of the kind of ideas polished down for the masses in that film, certainly the first.
Someone's just commented, with regard to cultural inertia, it's because we're in winter and terminal decline. We've seen this before in history, where culture is brought to a standstill and reverts back to nostalgia. But
yeah,
sure, but what amazes me is how suddenly it happened. I mean, it's not like we just slowly ground down and ran out of ideas and the production of new ideas decelerated. It was that it just literally everything stopped in 2000. I think it's that abrupt. I can't think of what new aesthetic emerged in the 2000s. I can't think of a single one. Or even music genre. Whereas the 90s was full of really full of this stuff. It's a very abrupt stop, I think. I mean, other people might disagree, but it doesn't really matter. But
no, I mean, I think generally, we're just talking generally about something. And it isn't just us. I mean, I've talked about this with many other people who think about things are coming from this from very different places. And it's a common theme I've had in conversation with many people. So and I think that's certainly a very good point. I mean, we are in a kind of winter. And obviously if we go back to some of the things we talked about at the beginning, you know, this idea of where, I mean, what is art? I mean, does art come from, is it a genuine sort of manifestation of kind of, you know, personal spiritual quest, whatever? It makes sense that there's this, that we've entered into this period of stasis, because I think that, you know, the soul of civilization is very much in jeopardy. And of course, you know, when you're faced with a critical life or death situation, then your energies are going to move to survival rather than to, you know, sort of the happy times of creation that you know you get in other ages of man. So so I do think that maybe this kind of inertia that we're talking about is a symptom of a deeper problem. That, of course,
it must be. It has to be.
And it's been the theme of, you know, again, all the conversation, many of the conversations you've had during Millennial so far. I mean, you know, it's very much in almost everything people in these circles talk about, this idea of things coming apart. You know, we all sense it. We all feel it. It's happening right in front of our eyes at this point.
Yeah. Someone said, brah, what? What are you talking about? Emo, new atheism, online console gaming, 4chan, all products of the 2000s. Right, well, yeah, okay. Online console gaming is not an aesthetic. It's something that people do. New atheism is not an aesthetic. It's, I mean, it's barely even a... It's barely even a set of ideas. It's really just a set of techniques. In fact, it's not even a set of techniques. It's a set of like snarky attitudes.
It did bring back the fedora, though.
I have one wonderful aesthetic product of the 2000s.
Yeah, it brought back spotty faces and fatness and the fedora. You know, all the things we love.
An aesthetic to die for. Well, so new atheism is really just this awful, wanky, it's just another type of deconstruction. Emo, yes, that was a new aesthetic, although it was, I mean, I wouldn't say it was that new. I wouldn't say it was very original. It was
kind of a rehash of like 80s goth, you know, in a lot of ways.
Well, mixing a wee bit with rave from the early 90s.
Yeah.
But in any case, that's the very start of the 2000s. And same with meme culture was invented by 2003 on the B board. Well, then that's 2003. That's 3 years. So yeah, sure. It's not an abrupt change in 2000. Like everything, there's still a bit of activity in the early 2000s. Fine.
Oh, there were memes. That's... There were memes before 4chan. Certainly, I remember. I mean. Terrible ones, but you know, there was. I mean, the meme culture is something that kind of was brewing and emerged in very early, very very early communication, pre-web communication, electronic communication. So, yes,
that's true. But either way, and I'm not trying to just ignore or dismiss this guy's point. I just think these things aren't really what we're talking about. We're not. What I'm talking about is new styles, new aesthetics, like so that you can look at a photo and think, "Oh yeah, that's within 2 years of this year." It's like 84 to 89. It's between 77 and 82, kind of thing. I don't think you can do that anymore. And you know, you might say, well, that's superficial. It doesn't really, but it does matter because it's a sign of what's going on. It's a sort of the standing wave of cultural activity. So it does matter in that sense alone. Now, I mean, one question would be, did culture or did aesthetics always change that fast? Or is this to do with the sort of hyper period after World War II? Is it something that only happened for like those 50 years? I'm not sure. I mean, what would you say about that? Would you say
I would say that you can find abrupt changes in certainly fashion, art styles, you know, sort of modes of dress, food, you know, styles of dance, all the way back. I mean, obviously the change wasn't quite as rapid because, of course, communication was much slower, but even you know, looking into the 18th century, the 17th century, you know, within 10 years, you could certainly discern great changes in fashion, great changes in kind of cultural products, and things went out of style. And I think it's very easy for modern people to kind of assume that the past didn't operate under the similar, that the humans were fundamentally different, and I think that in some ways they were, and many ways they weren't, you know. I mean, take, for instance, like Johann Sebastian Bach. You know, of course, we have this idea where he was just brilliant, transcendent composer who was always, you know, revered. Well, he was a brilliant, transcendent composer, but by the end of his life, he was thoroughly out of fashion. I mean, he was a relic of the past. in terms of what the musical taste of the strata of society who commissioned works of that nature, you know, he was a figure of the past, and it took a very long time for him to be revived into the 19th century for people to sort of become interested in him again. The same with Shakespeare. Yeah, I mean, Shakespeare never went out of fashion in quite the same way that contrapuntal fugal writing did. But, you know, so yeah, in the past there were these shifts, and they were abrupt, not quite as abrupt as, you know, the 20th century, but they did happen. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder, I mean, would you say that it was faster in the 20th century?
Oh, yes. I mean, just because, it was, you could immediately know. I mean, certainly after the 1950s, you know, you could immediately see what's happening in other parts of the country, other parts of the world. You know, products from America flooded over here, you know, with great rapidity and abandon. Obviously, and of course, as technology improved, then of course the acceleration of that kind of cross-pollination, you know, became faster as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, we started this off, I think I asked you about is society more sympathetic to the idea of the artist? See, my perception of this is that at this point we don't even, well, we clearly don't know. I mean, the art colleges themselves say that we don't know what an artist is. And I think that's true. I think they mean it. I think we no longer know what art is and what the artist is. Now, obviously, as you said, there are archetypes, there are things, stereotypes associated with the tortured artist, the romantic, the outsider, the obsessive. Now, what we would now call the autist, the Sperg, the bipolar, these kinds of emotional instability, and very driven, these things. But I don't think we really value. It's so strange. And someone asked this question: is it about religion? And I think it is. I think it at heart it is that religion furnishes people with an appreciation of life, which enables them to value the act of creation, where I think that without that, without religion, it's very difficult to do that, because I think you just start to adopt a very materialistic mindset where things are no longer meaningful.
Yeah,
and I think this is what distinguishes art from entertainment or art from furniture or whatever. It's the object is meaningful. It's more than just what you see.
I'm going to say something that's occasionally read as controversial, in that I don't think art, as with so many other ideas, the 20th century has taught us to think that egalitarianism is the way that life works, that is the organizing principle of all life. Democratization, egalitarianism, you know, this idea that everyone can share these experiences, everyone has a common ground from which they view the world and view culture. And I don't think that's true. I don't think that's ever been true. Art isn't for everyone. It's never been for everyone. In fact, it's only the 20th century and the 19th century. I think that's where that idea really began. The idea that, you know, that art is something that any person should be able to immediately dip in. You should leap into it like a swimming pool, and you're in the water, you know, and you can, you know, you can paddle around and find your way. And I just don't think that's true. I mean, it's always been, at least in some respect, kind of almost an esoteric world, an arcane world that needed entree and needed initiation, and that you had to kind of work your way into, and generally it had, and it would often have kind of, you know, in the West it had kind of cultural, social connotations. You know, you would be involved in the kind of appreciation of art if you were, you know, a churchman, if you were the kind of person who was commissioning an altarpiece, commissioning a screen for the church, a cathedral, or if you were an aristocrat who was commissioning artwork for your own collection or for some architectural project, something like that, or that even in further back, that artwork would be involved in a in a kind of religious ceremony, in a kind of cult, in a kind of in your villa in Pompeii. But it was never, this idea that art is something that everyone is born to participate in. I just don't think that's entirely true. And I people say, well, that's just a terribly elitist argument. Yes, it is.
Yeah. This is a process that destroys quite a lot of things, possibly everything.
Yeah.
Is the process of democratization. I remember. There was I don't even need to go into the example, because I think people will probably have examples from their own experience where something, you'll hear someone saying, it's great because we're democratizing X. The wonderful thing about this is that it democratizes Y. And it's like, they think it's great because it's opening it up to the whole world. And now anyone can do this. You don't need to have been trained in it. Now anyone can get started and do whatever, but what it seems to end up with is that everything just all the standards fall apart. I mean, if anyone can do X, then anyone doing X in any way and to any degree of quality is suddenly something to be applauded, when obviously that's just the road to ruin.
And I would think that people who are, who call themselves of the right or who call themselves reactionary would understand. I mean, it seems like a basic thing to understand, that there are hierarchies in the world. There are things that are the province of one group of people and that aren't the province of another group of people. I would think that that's just a very basic kind of lesson of whatever strand of the right you're on. I think we should probably agree on that. That the kind of this kind of egalitarian, democratic, popular notion of everyone having a share in every aspect of society, cultural, political, and otherwise, is nonsense. But I'm constantly surprised that, of course, that's not the case at all. Many people, in fact, throw up quite a bit of resistance when you talk like this. And it's odd. There's something about art. I mean, certainly the visual arts. I mean, it's almost like it's a reflex now that people expect, I don't have to understand anything else, but if you put some art that I don't get or that doesn't immediately satisfy my ideas of a good picture in front of me, I'm going to get very angry. I mean, just the idea of people getting upset about paintings in 2021 is a very strange one. I do wonder where that comes from.
Well, I think that people have a certain understanding. They feel that they should stand up for something, I guess, even if they don't know how to do it.
Mm. I just would think that there would be other things closer to people's hearts. Somebody say, I don't know anything about art, I don't ever look at art, but I hate that, and how dare you, I mean, it's obviously not that important to you. Why don't you stick to something that you know, something that you care about, and kind of pursue excellence in that? I'm just always amazed. This comes up for me because I use my Twitter account quite frequently to post art. I'll post an artwork or a series of artworks, every day or so, a few days, that sometimes on a theme, things that I like, things that I think are interesting, whatever. And so I'm often, that is often where I get these sort of reactions. It's very, very interesting to me. And of course, being an elitist with no time for that kind of nonsense, if people would say anything too stupid, then I just block them. but I do think people shouldn't be afraid of investing an area, sort of these important areas of kind of human culture, to the idea that it isn't for everyone, that it shouldn't be for everyone. You know,
that is a lesson I think
the right needs to learn about things, because of course we know. I mean, you know, I don't think you get many people who sort of place themselves on the right arguing with that when it comes to kind of political matters, certainly.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think there's this, the right is obviously always trying to be polite, and we're on the back foot. We don't know how to assert standards. And we know that the left will betray any standards that we try to establish. They'll just mock us for the very idea of having standards. I mean, this is a very typical. But I completely agree with you. I mean, we absolutely should get back to the idea that any particular thing is probably not for everyone. And there are things that, like, you know, what really infuriates me is when someone will say, like, I know that what I'm going to say is going to sound so snobbish. And
I love it. Do it.
Well, you know, when somebody will say, well, I like EastEnders, and then you might make the mistake of saying, yeah, but it's not Macbeth, is it? And then they'll say, well, yeah, but it's what I like. Yeah, I don't like Macbeth, but I do like EastEnders. And it's like, okay, so I've got to take this seriously, have I? I've got to pretend that your liking EastEnders is equal to my liking Macbeth. Well, it's just a nonsense.
That's a very good point, and of course I have said similar thing many, many times. You know, it's just like, okay, I don't care. Like, I'll get people that say, I hate this. I don't like this picture that you posted. You know, that you could easily scroll past. I don't understand why they feel the need to comment on it. Fine, okay, I don't like this. All right, that's fine. I don't like, chocolate very much. So what? You know, all right, I don't like chocolate. You don't like Jackson Pollock. What? That doesn't tell us anything. That isn't a kind of discussion that isn't getting at anything deeper. I mean, obviously we all have tastes, and I don't have any right to tell people that their tastes, you know, that they can't have their taste. But taste is,
you have the right not to take them seriously.
Yes, it's a primitive, metric upon which to judge higher culture, whether it be art, music, literature, or anything else. You know, your personal taste is meaningless. My personal taste is slightly less meaningless because I'm wonderful and a genius. But, you know, still, taste is not what you want to predicate your arguments on. And I do sort of, you know, all you have to do is you just go back to food, you know, because it doesn't, yeah, okay, some people don't like, you know, people don't like liver, some people don't like pate, some people don't like, you know, Wensleydale cheese. All right, that's fine, but that doesn't mean anything. That is not an indictment of, you know, of any of these things. And if so, you know, you have to be capable. If you want your opinion to mean something, then you have to be capable of having a conversation on a higher level than that. And I think you're absolutely right, Woz, that, you know, we don't have to take people, everyone seriously. Most people aren't worth taking seriously. You know, they just aren't.
Yeah,
certainly on particular
subjects. Yeah,
and on most things. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but you know, the past 2 years has taken my estimation of the intelligence of the average person and thrown it into the dustbin. You know, I used to have some faith in people, but the things I've seen people acquiesce to in regards to COVID, in regards to political questions, in regards to you know the direction that our society has taken, that people have just rolled over and accepted things, monstrous things. And so I become really blackpilled about the average person's qualification to talk about anything at all.
For sure. I mean, you know, I don't drink. I'm teetotal for reasons that are too boring to go into. But I never got the I never developed a taste for alcohol, and so I'm a complete virgin to the world of wine. I know absolutely nothing about wine, but you know, I really like that other people, that some other people get into it and become really. Connoisseurs, like aficionados, they know, experts at wine. Yeah. This is one example. You know, you could choose other things, sculpture, music, architecture. But I love it when you can detect that someone else really knows what they're talking about and has a not just knowledge and or understanding, but a unique appreciation, which is built upon that knowledge and understanding and is unique to them. So they have their own perspective on it, but it's a qualified perspective. It's an earned perspective.
Yes. Hierarchy.
Exactly. It's not just that they've imagined that they've dropped into the world and their opinion is valid on whatever topic. I mean, that's just the height of arrogance. You know, it's ironic because some people would say that you and I are being arrogant right now, speaking in such elitist terms. But what could be more arrogant than thinking that your opinion matters on a topic about which you know absolutely fucking nothing?
Yeah. And you know, again, if people, you know, and the same people, of course, talk about, we have to rebuild society, we have to take society back, we have to, you know, whatever, whatever. Well, if you want to do that, then you have to be willing to understand that it will be a network of people with expertise in one area or another area or another area. It will be a network of hierarchies, earned hierarchies. If you want to pull yourself out of the shit egalitarian morass that the kind of globalist powers that be have plunged the world, in which taste is everything and pleasure is everything. You know, there are no standards, there are no hierarchies, there are no there is no expertise other than worthless credentialism from some paused fucking university. If you want to escape from that, then you have to accept that there are hierarchies in all areas of life, you know, and if you want excellence in a society, then that is just a fundamental rule that you have to grasp, you know, because it is the forces that I think most of us hate that have imposed this idea of complete leveling egalitarianism on human society. And I think been one of the ruin of it. Well, one of the causes of ruin.
Yeah, it's very destructive. It's acid, really. It just enables, makes inevitable the dissolving of everything. Because you know, everyone is now, you cannot tell anyone that they're wrong about something. But the one thing that does get agreed upon is that elitism is bad. I mean, one of those, you know how you have a set, like in your life, there are some conversations that you just remember and you're going to remember that conversation forever. About 10 years ago now, I had this lunch with a bunch of people and, through a relative and his friend. And fucking hell, it came up that, because I can't remember how this came up, but someone was saying that the royal family should be more normal. And, you know, I don't approve of the royal family as we have them today. I approve of monarchy, but I don't approve of this particular royal family.
Same.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I respect the idea of monarchy, and I wish that they were more royal. I mean, I hate that Prince William and Harry don't even sound very posh. I hate that. I want them to sound I want them to sound better than the rest of us, because otherwise, why are they being held up like this? It doesn't make sense. But people at this lunch were saying, no, they should be more normal. They should be more like us. I can tell why, because it offends them to think that the royal family are better than them. But the thing is, the royal family should be better than them. Otherwise, why are they the royal family? it's absurd. I think this is something that came with reality TV as well. I think that people have this idea that, you can be elevated just for being yourself, or just on a whim, just some random chance. But it mustn't be something meaningful. It must be the distinction between the elevated person, the celebrity, and the normal person must not be something meaningful. It should be a trivial difference. Like, that person happened to win, it happened to get the winning lottery ticket, but that's it. Yeah, it's nothing that actually signals real tangible difference. But anyway, so that was one thing. And then in the same conversation, I don't know, we got talking about school, and I said, and I don't know if I was, you know, looking to stir things up here when I said this. In retrospect, maybe I was, but or maybe it came up innocently. I honestly can't. It seems more likely that I just said it innocently. I said something about how I really enjoyed learning Shakespeare at school, and these people, like this woman, said, "Oh, I don't think Shakespeare should be taught at school because it didn't." But she said, it doesn't help with getting a job. It's got nothing to do with getting a job, so why waste kids' time with it? And it's like, you know, this is why I know that you have to separate people. You have to treat different intelligence levels differently, because to put them all in the same place is, it leads to this kind of thing. Because that woman would happily go, she would wish that she had not been bothered with Shakespeare at school, because it got in the way of learning how to make spreadsheets or whatever. Whereas Shakespeare is the thing that I remember, that I am so, it's pretty much the only thing that I have a feeling of gratitude, like real gratitude for, about my education, is that they taught me about Shakespeare. Everything else was drivel.
Well, your first mistake was, you know, listening to woman in the first place. I think the opinions of women are certainly something that can easily be jestened, but that's just me.
Well, you know, I think that her husband agreed with her, for what it's worth.
It's a modern husband. Of course he's going to agree with her. I mean, you're right. I mean, of course, again, the powers that be, the elites, the globalists, whatever you want to call them, you know, this is their dream. The dream of complete utilitarianism. You know, that everything that is useful for perpetuating this rotten materialist global order, those are the things that are important. You know, and of course it's hurting people. I mean, you know, we've seen the damage it's done to generations of people. I really feel horrible, you know, for young people that have to grow up in this world at the moment. I mean, you really have to find your own way apart from this shite. And of course you have to be an autodidact. You have to, you know, now you have to kind of take it upon yourself to learn the things that they're not teaching you, because they're not going to teach you anything. You know, they can't even teach you what fucking sex you are, you know, anymore. So you know, so you've got to learn things for yourself. So if you want to read, I mean, I think one of the wonderful white pills, right, you know, these circles that we find ourselves in, is there's a great interest in sort of attaining knowledge, whether it's history of politics, you know, art, aesthetics, whatever. I mean, I see people, philosophy, you know, all the time graciously kind of thinking about things, thinking about ideas, talking about ideas, reading, you know, and that is very important, because they're not going to teach you that. You know, the educational system, as operated by the enemies of human civilization, they're not going to teach you the things that you need to know to be a proper man, to be a human being, to be a soul in the world, like, you, as you say, Shakespeare, poetry, history, aesthetics, all those.
This is, someone's just said she probably shouldn't have been taught Shakespeare, and Woz should have been in a much higher quality school than she would attend. But you know, that is true. And the thing is, it probably was a waste of her time for her to be confronted with Shakespeare, because she obviously got nothing out of it. So it probably was wasting her time. So in a sense, I agree with that comment, and I understand. But this is exactly why I said at the start, a few minutes ago, that this is why people have to be treated differently. Absolutely, she should not. I mean, oh God. Anyway, she should not be in the same school as me, and I should not have to. Oh God. Yeah. What can I say? And I'm not saying this to, you know, puff myself up. It's because I have genuine frustration that I had to deal with, I had to confront, be hampered with people like that. I mean, this is part of why you want to get out of your home time, you know, when you're young, because you need to find your kind, as it were. But yeah, it's a thing, you know, but she and people like her are, that is the majority. And so they don't have that need, because they've already, they're happy with the average person, because they are the average person. And, you know, even to say those words, I know it makes me sound arrogant and pretentious, perhaps. But it's the truth. And we absolutely need to be able to say this stuff without guilt, but without also ostentatious, you know, arrogance or ego, but also without guilt. We need to be able to say, no, I am better than most people in this sense. You know, and they might be better than me in other senses, but I am better than them.
And that's the end of the matter. Yeah, and all these things aren't for everyone. I don't think that everyone should learn Shakespeare, because, you know, there's many people that again, it
clearly doesn't do them any good.
Well, they don't have the aptitude for it. They don't have the interest in it, but they may have the interest in something else. I mean, one of the most horrible things of all is, of course, the Blairite project of sending everyone to university, you know, and allowing the trades to languish. I mean, it's
an
absolutely vital part of society are all of the brilliant men who can perform these trades and perform them with mastery. Now all we have is this kind of regulatory box ticking. You know, we call people electricians who've taken a 2-week course. You know, we've even lost the mastery in the trades, you know, in whatever the trade may be, in cookery, in all of these areas of life. It isn't just the high culture that suffered, it's the entire culture.
You're absolutely right. And this is the thing, because, you know, for a guy who's not ever going to appreciate Shakespeare, a meaningful life comes from performing a role, performing a purpose, so that he has purpose and so that he has respect from his peers and from his society, so that he feels that he's needed. And that, for a lot of guys, is going to be learning a trade, learning a skilled craft or whatever. But if you tell them instead to go to university and learn, you know, spend 3 years learning some nonsense, then they're not going to have that. They're going to end up in a call center, which is what so many, I mean, it's depressing. It's really depressing, actually, to think about this, because this is why, you know, a good future, I think, has to feature things becoming localized again. Even if we could do it technologically, even if we could do it in a globalistic way, we should probably choose to do it in a localistic way. I think, am I making these words up? I'm not sure. But anyway.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I think we should artificially choose to do it this way, because otherwise, how are you going to make meaningful the lives of vast numbers of your population?
You said something a few minutes ago, the idea of the sort of having to leave and find yourself and find your kind of your people. But I do think it's actually the kind of opposite thing that we need to focus on. We need to find a way to, you know, to make where we come from. And that doesn't necessarily mean, again, just staying where you were born. But, you know, we need to find a way to make what is local to us functional and rich and alive again, rather than this idea of draining everybody away to fucking London or wherever it is. You know, to like you said, work in a call center, working in a meaningless, you know, kind of corporate you know, job. I mean, so, yeah.
This is the thing. When I say, you know, someone else's opinion on X topic should not be respected, they don't know, they don't have the mental apparatus to appreciate this thing. That's not me just saying it to be horrible. It's because it's the only way that these things can be respected. If you say that everyone can appreciate this, then that thing becomes degraded, clearly.
Yeah.
And one example of this is, you know, high art, high culture, high literature. But at the other, it's also true of the skilled trades and so on, because it's no longer something that is being taken seriously. If instead we just say, well, give it to the Chinese sweatshop workers, you know, then that skilled trade becomes a meaningless thing. And we are no longer respecting it. See, everything should be done appropriately. Yeah, that's the key thing here.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you were saying about this earlier, it occurred to me there was a thing I saw a couple of months ago that, and I brought this up in an earlier stream, that there was an organization that's gone for a long time in Devon called the Devon Guild of Craftsmen.
Hmm.
And they've just changed their name to...
Uh-oh.
It's so awful, you won't believe it. They've changed it from the Devon Guild of Craftsmen to Make. Make Southwest, I think.
Of course, Make. Yeah, we're all makers now. You used to be a cabinet. You used to be a carpenter. You're a maker. This hipsterization. That's what brings up one thing that I thought of earlier when we talk about wine. You know, I mean, connoisseurship and expertise is one thing, but there is this level of wankery that kind of middle class people of a certain stripe like to go into, where, you know,
there are many types of wankery that middle class.
But I'm just thinking of the kind of coffee snob, you know, the person who goes to kind of coffee cuppings and talks about the kind of raspberry notes and, oh, is this fair trade? Did this pass through the digestive system of a civet, you know? And was it, you know, do you know the name of a man who picked the beans out of the civet shit? And, you know, this sort of like, again, and it goes back to this idea that when I say that it's there's nothing wrong with being elitist, there is a sort of person who is attracted to elitism, not because they care about hierarchy, they care about excellence, but because it's a symbol of status. And I tend to call this kind of middle class, you know, it's the person who puts PhD in their Twitter handle. And that isn't what when I talk about elitism, that is not what I'm talking about at all. I mean, like everything else, there are people who will pathologize the idea of a kind of expertise or hierarchy and turn it into this kind of credential worthless wankery, you know. So I do think it's very important to make that distinction there. And as you said, exploring these ideas with to lord it over people. It is not something that should be kind of social climbing credential. No. So I hope that that's clear, you know, because there's almost nothing I hate worse than that type of person, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Something, and people can be really nasty with it as well.
Oh yeah,
when they detect that there's a vulnerability in you. So I'll just make a sly comment that will touch on an insecurity and make you feel like you don't really belong. I mean, that nastiness that, you know, some people use their position or their authority or whatever to just be nasty. And you know, that is obviously not something I approve of.
Yeah.
You know, it's happened to me once or twice when I was younger, when you'd get into that situation where someone would realize that they could do that to you. It's horrible. It's a really nasty thing. But no, I don't approve of that at all.
And that is generally the product of insecurity. It is a kind of bourgeois insecurity.
Yes, it's them themselves. If they were genuinely secure in their position, they wouldn't feel the need to do that kind of thing.
I don't think,
at least. I'm not sure, because again, it's one of those things where it's quite difficult to distinguish that from the upper class person who really is just arrogant. Like, it's not that they're insecure; they're just nasty. They're just horrible.
Well, a true aristocrat is not going to be that way. I mean, you do have to distinguish between the idea of an aristocracy based upon a kind of spiritual merit, and one based on just mundane financial achievement. You know, they're two different things. It's like it's like monarchy. You know, just like, you know, obviously the Windsors, you know, there's a difference between that idea of monarchy and a true spiritual idea of monarchy. You know, we can tell the difference. You can just detect the fake from the real in many circumstances. So.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for me, it's all about things being done respectfully and appropriately. That's what seems to matter here. In this, like, that woman should not have the right to comment on Shakespeare, but at the same time, she should not be insulted by or talked down to by being forced to learn Shakespeare, because it's inappropriate. It's not appropriate for her to be lumbered with that, because it only... Well, it might well show her that she's not that bright, or it might, which is even worse in a way, it might give her the feeling that she has the right to judge this stuff. And either of those is undesirable, because you know, either you're being cruel to her or you're enabling her to denigrate the thing itself, which is quite damaging. But anyway, look, I think we should maybe... wrap this up, because I am getting quite tired, and
half four in the morning. Yeah. Half 4 in the morning. See,
let me just check the. I think there were a couple of questions. I'll just get them. Sensum Communum says, "Hello, MW. This year's millennial once again has been superb with fantastic and knowledgeable guests." Thank you very much. Mr. D joining Academic Agent on Unpopular Opinions has been a welcome addition. Happy New Year to the two of you. I wish you all the best for 2022. Well, thank you very much, Sensum Communum.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, and quite a few. Hello, Mr. D. I was entirely unfair to you on a chat concerning Kyle Rittenhouse. I thought that by celebrating his bravery, you were trivializing his support of the BLM scum. I was so wrong. Only when I saw the footage did I realize how truly brave and heroic he was. I owe you an apology. Oh. There you go. That's someone called, he says Ryan Thompson. That's his name.
All right.
There you go.
Fair enough.
And Reaping Justice says, it depends on what the art is. If you go into St. Peter's Basilica... See, this is the kind of thing... Imagine someone going into, I don't know, like the Sistine Chapel and saying, yeah, it could be better. Yeah, it's all right. It's fine. Yeah. Someone who knew nothing about it, judging it. Isn't that just monstrous?
Yeah, I've heard unimaginable thing of that nature. So,
yeah. Okay. If you go into St. Peter's Basilica and look at the architecture, everyone will appreciate it, but aristocrats will get the reference. It's like when you watch a movie meant for children and there are jokes or references that only adults will get. Yeah, there is that sort of clever side to it. But I think also there's a more instinctual sort of or sensory appreciation, which isn't, I don't know. I, this is sort of, this is quite nuanced. I think it's more instinctual, as much as there is the intellectual side of this stuff as well. But yeah, I take the point. At any rate, learning about something is probably only going to increase your or deepen your appreciation of it. Okay, and Zibble says, although my IQ tests high, I have a suspicion I would have been a dumbass in Shakespearean England, as his writings were populist-directed and meant for the common man to enjoy. This is something that always baffles me, because, and you know, and you hear people, I remember about 15 years ago, it was really common to hear on TV someone saying something like, Shakespeare was the EastEnders of his day.
No.
Which, you know...
No. I would dispute the idea that it was written with a populist perspective. I mean, obviously there were, you know, the groundlings. There were, you know, obviously all strata of society could go to these plays and derive some enjoyment from them. But if you certainly read the works and study them, it's clear that they were certainly not written for the average person. You know, I mean, I'm not a Shakespeare expert. I'm an academic agent, probably have more to say about this, but I don't think that's a correct characterization. You know, I mean, I'm trying to think of a sort of example that makes sense. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, you go to a play there. I mean, the average person would have been slightly more in tune with the language. It would have been less difficult for even a moderately uneducated person to understand the language of the day, because it was to some extent the lingua franca of society. And for us, it's a bit more difficult because, of course, English has moved on. But you know, also there were sword fights, there was intrigue, there was love, there was murder. There were all sorts of things going on that the average person, you know, could point out and say, you know, ooh, that's cool. You know, but the meat of that poetry. I mean, of course, it was a drama. It was staged, and of course, these people knew what they were doing. Shakespeare and the King's Men, you know, they knew how to put on a show. But if you look into the actual poetry, it's a very high level, written for a very high level person. So you know.
That's the thing. I mean, you only have to compare like the dialogue in a soap opera today with the dialogue in any, you know, Romeo and Juliet. I mean, is there any dialogue in Emmerdale that is as perceptive of the human condition and expressive of quite obscure things? Is there anything in Emmerdale that can rival Romeo and Juliet for that? I really, really doubt it. It seems completely preposterous.
Yeah, and again, it isn't. I can't remember who it was. You know, who? Was it Rentigan? The
early pioneer. Terence Rentigan.
No. Rentigan. I'm not pronouncing it correctly. One of the early pioneers of X-ray, of using X-rays to make images, and he basically saw he took an X-ray of his wife's hand, and basically through that it was almost the mundane the hand of his wife that he'd seen a thousand times, and suddenly he's looking at the bones of it like no one had ever been able to do before, and it was almost seeing the kind of the clockwork mystery of God, you know, underneath the surface. And I think that there's the same sort of sense about Shakespeare. Is obviously the plot is one thing, the kind of character is one thing, but if you look at the language, at the kind of beautiful molecules of the words and the sound and the poetry there, that is where the sublime aspect of Shakespeare, or certainly one of the loci of the sublime in Shakespeare, lies. You know, it is this kind of divine structure underneath, and that is something that takes quite a lot of work to kind of tease out. But you know, but I mean, as the person said about St. Peter's, you know, it works on different levels for different people, you know, so.
Yeah, for, indeed. It works on different levels. I'm just seeing these, there are various comments that I could reply to, but, you know, I'm tired. I'm sorry. Gus Faye says the NFT looks amazing. Owning it would give one bragging rights. Well, I'm sure he's correct, and you know, you can bid on it if you're interested. I can't remember where the URL is for that. Actually, hold on a second. I'll get it because there it is. It's going to close on the day after tomorrow, I guess, I think it is the 31st. So there it is. I'll paste it into the chat.
Men of wealth and taste should look into it, I should say.
Yes, exactly. Let me see the other one. Yes, Chain Reaction says, have a good one, and thanks, Woz, guest, mods, and chat. And also, there's one from Semiogog from earlier on, quite a long time ago, actually, and he said, I'd be interested to hear Dee's opinion on art and its relationship with politics, if indeed any such association can or should be proposed. And if the idea of a relationship between art and politics isn't objectionable to him, I'd be interested in how his art and his politics might accommodate each other. That's maybe something that, I mean, that's quite involved, if you were to give a worthy answer. It's maybe something that, you could do a stream with Semiogog about that.
Yeah, so certainly that is a whole kettle of fish, but it's a very, very interesting question. I just think we're both too knackered to get into that.
Yes, I think so. But, you know, this is the thing. I don't really, you can get into the whole relationship between art and politics, and I tend to think that political art is kind of obscene. I don't really think that art should be at least explicitly political, because then it just becomes, well, there's a huge danger of it just being propaganda.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if it's implicitly political, like your ideas are going to seep through it, then that seems more innocent. I don't mind that. But I find the idea of like deliberately making political art to make some kind of political point, well, then you may as well do a meme. You know, it's not...
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm very precious about the idea that the creation of an artwork should involve blood, sweat, and tears. It should be difficult. It should cost you. The artist should suffer for making it in order to make it. Because otherwise, I suppose it's the old thing about meaningfulness and sacrifice, you know, meaning and suffering. Can you really have something meaningful if it were created with no real effort? So if you did do that, then why would you want it to be just some sort of political, like crass political propaganda? Yeah. You'd want it to have its own innocence, surely.
Yeah, and you know, again, there is a branch of art. I mean, propaganda. You know, the political propaganda. And of course, yes, you can, if you wish, you can use your talents and your muse to approach that. But that's a very different thing from, you know, I think we're talking about art, we're talking about art with a capital A, you know, the kind of fine arts, one way or the
other. Is there any other kind?
I'm a bit more Catholic in my orientation towards what I call art, but I do think there is a place for those things, and for my own work, I don't address political concerns openly, but I think that, you know, the political is the surface. I mean, that those are concerns of the temporal surface world. I do think that, of course, there's metaphysical questions about the arrangement of life and the dispensation of the soul that are, of course, tied to the political in one way or the other. I mean, the political is kind of moored to them to keep it from floating away, and of course, I do think art addresses those, and I think that in a way, of course, one will trickle down into the other. But I think when you start to address the surface of things, when you start to address these temporal, you know, fleeting concerns in something in art, which I think always properly deals with huge timescales rather than short timescales, then it just becomes cheap. You've deadened its impact. You've given it a short life rather than eternity.
Yes, that makes exactly. Sense. Exactly. You've made it into something that can be understood and consumed and then discarded.
Yeah, and like a leaf, it has its life, and it will turn brown, it will fall, and it will blow away. When you consign it to the, you know, to these temporal concerns. So you know, but it's a good question, and I would be very interested to talk about that at length. Semi-God, so maybe we'll do that.
Yeah, I'm sure he will be. I can put you in touch with him if you're not already.
We're pals.
Okay, of course. And there was somebody who said a lot. I've forgotten the wording. A lot of great art is explicitly political. So, okay, I'm willing to go along with that. I am willing to accept that. I just think there are ways to go about it, and there are ways to do it very crassly. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, even Shakespeare, there were political concerns.
Oh, obviously. Political concerns. Fine. It's when it's the point of it is just to deliver a message, like
yes,
the workers should have better conditions, or something like that. You know, it's just what's the difference between that and some modern LGBT propaganda?
Exactly. There has to be something. There has to be hidden depth there, and I think obviously even in things that may have been intended to be, you know, specifically political, you know, I'm thinking Anthony Van Dyck's portraits of Charles I, you know, there was something else happening there beyond the political, and that's why we remember them, you know.
Exactly. I think that politics can tend to cheapen things. I think I honestly have this maybe elitist or maybe certain dreamy notion that art should be above politics, because I think that politics is a bit tawdry. As you say, it's sort of tied to the here and now. And I like the idea of art being something transcendent.
Yeah. But, you know, again, if people think of themselves on the right or reactionaries or whatever you call it, I mean, politics is only one facet of that, of this reimagining, a reorganization of civilization. And of course, I would hope that people have deeper goals in mind. You know, the politics is a way of achieving, I think, deeper, broader, bigger things. And those are the kind of province of art. And so it's all part of the same organism. But you focus too much on one aspect, and then you very much limited what, you know, the impact of what you're doing.
Yes. Indeed. So Trad Dad says that he bought the millennial t-shirt tonight. Thanks, Woz. Been watching for years now. Well, thank you very much, Trad Dad. And I'm glad that you're still around watching me. It's always nice to know that people stick with me. And I hope you enjoy the t-shirt. I hope you wear it with pride. Chips and Salsa 99 says, really good stream. Woz was in his element here. Yes, I was. I have enjoyed this. And I've wanted to have a conversation like this for a long time because, well, for obvious reasons. I mean, it's not good to just fucking, you know, go on about politics or the Great Reset or COVID or you know, mass immigration and all that. This is the kind of stuff that I like. And actually, I wish I was better at talking about this stuff, because I feel like I've neglected this side of myself for 20 years, really, since art college. Hopefully, I'll do that. Hopefully, I'll get better at this kind of thing, because it feels like my natural territory in a way.
Yeah.
And then Sensum Communum said, great stream with Mr. D. I hope he returns in 2022. Well, I hope so too. So, I've really enjoyed this. So thank you for agreeing to appear.
Well, thank you for asking me. It was a wonderful surprise, and I'm delighted to join in.
Okay, great. It was good. I'm glad that we were able to arrange it. All right. Well, I will be back tomorrow. I'm not sure what with, but it will either be Morgoth at 8 p.m. and then, you know, nothing else, or it will be four other streams starting at 8 p.m. tomorrow with Morgoth the following day. I will see. We'll have to see. I'm not sure yet. So, either way, I will be back tomorrow at the same time. So, in the meantime, Mr. D, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
Very welcome.
Okay. I'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.